paranoid fixation. But Paul understood now that the wellspring had been the same. The Scheherazade complex. The deep and elemental drawing power of the Gata. His floating deepened. He slept. He dozed off these days as old men doze off, abruptly and sometimes at inappropriate times, and he slept as old men sleep, which is to say only separated from the waking world by the thinnest of skins. He didn't stop hearing the riding mower, but its sound became deeper, rougher, choppier, the sound of the electric knife. He had picked the wrong day to start complaining about the Royal and its missing end. And of course there never was a right day to say no to Annie Wilkes. Punishment might be deferred, but never escaped. "Well, if it bothers you so much, I'll just have to give you something to take your mind off that old inn." He heard her rummaging around in the kitchen, throwing things, cursing in her strange Annie Wilkes language. 10 minutes later she came in with a syringe, the betadine, and the electric knife. Paul began to scream at once. He was, in a way, like Pavlov's dogs. When Pavlov rang a bell, the dogs salivated. When Annie came into the guest bedroom with a hypo, a bottle of betadine, and a sharp cutting object, Paul began to scream. She had plugged the knife into the outlet by his wheelchair, and there had been more pleading and more screaming and more promises that he would be good. When he tried to thrash away from the hypo, she told him to sit still and be good, or what was going to happen would happen without the benefit of even light anesthesia. When he continued to pull away from the needle, mewling and pleading, Annie suggested that if that was really the way he felt, maybe she just ought to use the knife on his throat and be done with it. Then he had been still, and let her give him the injection. And this time the betadine had gone over his left thumb as well as the blade of the knife. When she turned it on and the blade began to saw rapidly back and forth in the air, the betadine flew in a spray of maroon droplets she seemed not to notice. And in the end, of course, there had been much redder droplets spraying into the air as well. Because when Annie decided on a course of action, she carried it through. Annie was not swayed by pleas. Annie was not swayed by screams. Annie had the courage of her convictions. As the humming, vibrating blade sank into the soft web of flesh between the soon-to-be-defunct thumb and his first finger, she assured him again in her this-hurts-mother-more-than-it-hurts-Polly voice that she loved him. Then, that night, "You're not dreaming, Paul. You're thinking about things you don't dare think about when you're awake. So wake up. For God's sake, wake up." He couldn't wake up. She had cut his thumb off in the morning, and that night she had swept gaily into the room where he sat in a stupid daze of drugs and pain, with his wrapped left hand held against his chest, and she had a cake, and she was bellowing "Happy birthday to you" in her on-key but tuneless voice, although it was not his birthday, and there were candles all over the cake, and sitting in the exact center, pushed into the frosting like an extra big candle, had been his thumb, his gray dead thumb, the nail slightly ragged because he sometimes chewed it when he was stuck for a word. And she told him, "If you promise to be good, Paul, you can have a piece of birthday cake. You won't have to eat any of the special candle." So he promised to be good, because he didn't want to be forced to eat any of the special candle, but also because mostly because surely, because Annie was great, Annie was good, let us thank her for our food, including that we don't have to eat. Girls just want to have fun, but something wicked this way comes. Please don't make me eat my thumb. Annie the mom, Annie the goddess. When Annie's around, you better stay honest. She knows when you've been sleeping. She knows when you're awake. She knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. You better not cry, you better not pout. But most of all, you better not scream. Don't scream. Don't scream. Don't scream. Don't. He hadn't. And now as he awoke, he did so with a jerk that hurt him all over, hardly aware that his lips were pressed tightly together to keep the scream inside, although the thumbectomy had happened over a month ago. He was so preoccupied with not screaming that for a moment he didn't even see what was coming into the driveway, and when he did see it, he He believed at first that it must be a mirage. It was a Colorado State Police car. Following the amputation of his thumb, there had been a dim period when Paul's greatest single accomplishment, other than working on the novel, had been to keep track of the days. He had become pathological about it, sometimes spending as long as 5 minutes lost in a daze, counting back, making sure he hadn't somehow forgotten one. "I'm getting as bad as she is," he thought once. His mind had returned wearily. So what? He had done pretty well with a book following the loss of his foot, during what Annie so mincingly called his convalescent period. No, pretty well was false modesty if ever there was such a thing. He had done amazingly well for a man who had once found it impossible to write if he was out of cigarettes, or if he had a backache or a headache a degree or two above a low drone. It would be nice to believe he had performed heroically, but he supposed it was only that escape thing again, because the pain had been really dreadful. When the healing process finally did begin, he thought the phantom itch of the foot which was no longer there was even worse than the pain. It was the arch of the missing foot which bothered him the most. He awoke time after time in the middle of the night, using the big toe of his right foot to scratch thin air, 4 inches below the place where, on that side, his body now ended. But he had gone on working just the same. It wasn't until after the thumbectomy, and that bizarre birthday cake like a leftover prop from whatever happened to baby Jane, that the balls of crumpled-up paper had begun to proliferate in the wastebasket again. Lose a foot, almost die, go on working. Lose a thumb and run into some kind of weird trouble. Wasn't it supposed to be the other way around? Well, there was the fever. He had spent a week in bed with that. But it was pretty minor league stuff. The highest his temperature had ever gone was 100.7, and that wasn't exactly the stuff of which high melodrama was made. The fever had probably been caused more by his general rundown condition than any specific infection, and an oogie old fever was no problem for Annie. Among her other souvenirs, Annie had Keflex and ampicillin up the old kazoo. She dosed him and he got better as it was possible to get under such bizarre circumstances at any rate. But something was wrong. He seemed to have lost some vital ingredient, and the mix had become a lot less potent as a result. He tried to blame it on the missing N, but he'd had that to contend with before. And really, what was a missing N compared to a missing foot? And now, as an extra added attraction, a missing thumb. Whatever the reason, something had disturbed the dream. Something was whittling away the circumference of that hole in the paper through which he saw. Once he would have sworn it was so. That hole had been as big as the bore of the Lincoln Tunnel. Now it was no more than the size of a knothole, through which a sidewalk superintendent might stoop to snoop on an interesting piece of building construction. You had to peer and crane to see anything at all, and more often than not the really important things happened outside your field of vision. Not surprising, considering the field of vision was so small. In practical terms, what had happened following the thumbectomy and ensuing bouts of fever was obvious. The language of the book had grown florid and overblown again. It was not self-parody yet, not quite, but it was floating steadily in that direction, and he seemed helpless to stop it. Continuity lapses had begun to proliferate, with the stealth of rats breeding in cellar corners. For a space of 30 pages, the Baron had become the Viscount from Misery's Quest. He'd had to go back and tear that all out. "It doesn't matter, Paul," he told himself again and again, in those last few days before the Royal coughed up its first T and then its E. "The damn thing is almost done." So it was. Working on it was torture, and finishing it was going to mean the end of his life. That the latter had begun to look slightly more attractive than the former said all that probably needed to be said about the worsening state of his body, mind, and spirit. And the book moved on in spite of everything, seemingly independent of them. The continuity drops were annoying but minor. He was having more problems with the actual make-believe than he ever had before. The game of Can You had become a labored exercise rather than simple, good fun. Yet the book had continued to roll, in spite of all the terrible things Annie had subjected him to, and he could bitch about how something, his guts maybe, had run out of him along with a half pint or so of blood he'd lost when she took his thumb. But it was still a goddamn good yarn, the best misery novel by far. The plot was melodramatic but well-constructed, in its own modest way quite amusing. If it were ever published in something other than the severely limited, first printing one copy, Annie Wilkes edition, he guessed it might sell like a mad bastard. Yeah, he supposed he would get through it, if the goddamn typewriter held together. "You're supposed to be so tough," he had thought once, after one of his compulsive lifting exercises. His thin arms were trembling, the stump of his thumb aching feverishly, his forehead covered with a thin oil of sweat. "You were the tough young gunsel looking to make a rep off the tired old turd of a sheriff, right? Only you've already thrown one key, and I see the way some of the others, the T, the E, and the G, for instance, are starting to look funny. Sometimes leaning one way, sometimes leaning the other. Sometimes riding a little high on the line, sometimes dipping a little low. I think maybe the tired old turd is going to win this one, my friend. I think maybe the tired old turd is going to beat you to death. And it could be that the bitch knew it. Could be that's why she took my left thumb. Like the old saying goes, she may be crazy, but she sure ain't dumb." He had looked at the typewriter with tired intensity. "Go on. Go on and break. I'll finish anyway. If she wants to get me a replacement, I'll thank her kindly. But if she doesn't, I'll finish on my goddamn legal pads. The one thing I won't do is scream. I won't scream. I won't. I won't scream." He sat at the window, totally awake now, totally aware that the police car he was seeing in Annie's driveway was as real as his left foot had once been. "Scream! God damn it, scream!" He wanted to, but the dictum was too strong, just too strong. He didn't even open his mouth. He tried and saw the brownish droplets of betadine flying from the blade of the electric knife. He tried and heard the squeal of the axe against bone, the soft flump as the match in her hand lit the burns-o-matic. He tried to open his mouth and couldn't. Tried to raise his hands, couldn't. A horrible moaning sound passed between his closed lips, and his hands made light, haphazard drumming sounds on either side of the royal, but that was all he could do, all the control of his destiny he could seem to take. Nothing which had gone before, except perhaps for the moment when he realized that although his left leg was moving, his left foot was staying put, was as terrible as the hell of this immobility. In real time, it did not last long, perhaps 5 seconds, and surely no longer than 10. But inside Paul Sheldon's head, it seemed to go on for years. There, within plain sight, was salvation. All he had to do was break the window, and the dog lock the bitch had put on his tongue, and scream, "Help me! Help me! Save me from Annie! Save me from the goddess!" At the same time, another voice was screaming, "I'll be good, Annie. I won't scream. I'll be good. I'll be good for goddess sake. I promise not to scream. Just don't chop off any more of me." Had he known? Before this, had he really known how badly she had cowed him? Or how much of his essential self, the liver and lights of his spirit, she had scraped away. He knew how constantly he had been terrorized, but did he know how much of his own subjective reality, once so strong he had taken it for granted, had been erased? He knew one thing with some certainty. A lot more was wrong with him than paralysis of the tongue, just as a lot more was wrong with what he had been writing than the missing key, or the fever, or continuity lapses, or even a loss of guts. The truth of everything was so simple in its horridness, so dreadfully simple. He was dying by inches. But dying that way wasn't as bad as he'd already feared. But he was also fading, and that was an awful thing because it was moronic. "Don't scream!" The panicky voice screamed just the same as the cop opened the door of the cruiser and stepped out, adjusting his smoky bear hat as he did so. He was young, no more than 22 or 23, wearing sunglasses as black and liquid-looking as dollops of crude oil. He paused to adjust the creases of his khaki uniform pants, and 30 yards away, a man with blue eyes bulging from his white and whiskery old man's face sat staring at him from behind a window, moaning through closed lips, hands rattling uselessly on a board laid across the arms of a wheelchair. "Don't scream. Yes, scream. Scream and it will be over. Scream and it can end. Never, never going to end. Not until I'm dead. That kid's no match for the goddess. Paul, oh Christ, are you dead already? Scream, you chicken shit motherfucker. Scream your fucking head off." His lips pulled apart with a minute tearing sound. He hitched air into his lungs and closed his eyes. He had no idea what was going to come out or if anything really was, until it came. "Africa!" Paul screamed. Now his trembling hands flew up like startled birds and clapped against the sides of his head, as if to hold in his exploding brains. "Africa! Africa, help me! Help me, Africa!" His eyes snapped open. The cop was looking toward the house. Paul could not see the smoky's eyes because of the sunglasses, but the tilt of his head expressed moderate puzzlement. He took a step closer, then stopped. Paul looked down at the board. To the left of the typewriter was a heavy ceramic ashtray. Once upon a time, it would have been filled with crushed butts. Now it held nothing more hazardous to his health than paper clips and a typewriter eraser. He seized it and threw it at the window. Glass shattered outward. To Paul, it was the most liberating sound he had ever heard. "The walls came tumbling down," he thought giddily, and screamed. "Over here! Help me! Watch out for the woman! She's crazy!" The state cop stared at him. His mouth dropped open. He reached into his breast pocket and brought out something that could only be a picture. He consulted it, and then advanced to the edge of the driveway. There he spoke the only 4 words Paul ever heard him say, the last 4 words anyone ever heard him say. Following them, he would make a number of inarticulate sounds, but no real words. "Oh, shit!" the cop exclaimed. "It's you!" Paul's attention had been so fiercely focused on the trooper that he did not see Annie until it was too late. When he did see her, he was struck by a real superstitious horror. Annie had become a goddess, a thing that was half woman and half lawn boy, a weird female centaur. Her baseball cap had fallen off. Her face was twisted in a frozen snarl. In one hand she held a wooden cross. It had marked the grave of the bossy. Paul didn't remember if it was number 1 or number 2, which had finally stopped bawling. That bossy had indeed died, and when spring had softened the ground enough, Paul had watched from his window, sometimes dumbstruck with awe and sometimes overcome with shrieking attacks of the giggles, as she first dug the grave. It had taken her most of the day, and then dragged Bossy, who had also softened considerably, out from behind the barn. She had used a chain attached to the Cherokee's trailer hitch to do this. She had looped the other end of the chain around Bossy's middle. Paul made a mental bet with himself that Bossy would tear in half before Annie got her to the grave, but that one he lost. Annie tumbled Bossy in, then stolidly began refilling the hole, a job she hadn't finished until long after dark. Paul had watched her plant the cross and then read the Bible over the grave by the light of the new-risen spring moon. Now she was holding the cross like a spear. The dirt-darkened point of its vertical post pointed squarely at the trooper's back.
"Behind you! Look out!"
Paul shrieked, knowing he was too late, but shouting anyway. With a thin, warbling cry, Annie plunged Bossy's cross into the trooper's back.
"Ugh,"
the cop said, and walked slowly onto the lawn, his pierced back arched and his gut sticking out. His face was the face of a man either trying to pass a kidney stone or having a terrible gas attack. The cross began to droop toward the ground as the trooper approached the window in which Paul sat, his gray invalid's face framed by jags of broken glass. The cop reached slowly over his shoulders with both hands. He looked to Paul like a man trying very hard to scratch that one itch you can never quite reach. Annie had dismounted the lawn boy and had been standing frozen, her tented fingers pressed against the peaks of her breasts. Now she lunged forward and snatched the cross out of the trooper's back. He turned toward her, groping for his service pistol, and Annie drove the cross point first into his belly.
"Ugh!"
the cop said this time, and dropped to his knees, clutching his stomach. As he bent over, Paul could see the slit in his brown uniform shirt where the first blow had gone home. Annie pulled the cross free again. Its sharpened point had broken off, leaving a jagged, splintery stump, and drove it into his back between the shoulder blades. She looked like a woman trying to kill a vampire. The first two blows had perhaps not gone deep enough to do much damage, but this time the cross's support post went at least 3 inches into the kneeling trooper's back, driving him flat.
"There!"
Annie cried, wrenching Bossy's memorial marker out of his back.
"How do you like that, you old dirty bird?"
"Annie, stop it!" Paul shouted. Annie looked up at him, her dark eyes momentarily as shiny as coins, her hair fungus frowsy around her face, the corners of her mouth drawn up in the jolly grin of a lunatic who has, at least for the moment, cast aside all restraints. Then she looked back down at the state trooper.
"There!"
she cried, and drove the cross into his back again, and his buttocks, and the upper thigh of one leg, and his neck, and his crutch, and stabbed him with it a half a dozen times, screaming,
"There!"
every time she brought it down again. Then the cross's upright split.
"There,"
she said, almost conversationally, and walked away in the direction from which she had come running. Just before she passed from Paul's view, she tossed the bloody cross aside as if it no longer interested her. Paul put his hands on the wheels of the chair, not at all sure where he intended to go, or what, if anything, he meant to do when he got there. To the kitchen for a knife, perhaps. Not to try to kill her with. Oh, no. She would take one look at the knife in his hand and step back into the shed for her 30-30. Not to kill her, but to defend himself from her revenge by cutting his wrists open. He didn't know if that had been his intention or not, but it surely did seem like a hell of a good idea, because if there had ever been a time to exeunt stage left, this was it. He was tired of losing pieces of himself to her fury. Then he saw something which froze him in place. The cop. The cop was still alive. He raised his head. His sunglasses had fallen off. Now Paul could see his eyes. Now he could see how young the cop was, how young and hurt and scared. Blood ran down his face in streams. He managed to get to his hands and knees, fell forward, and then got painfully back up again. He began to crawl toward his cruiser. He worked his way halfway down the mild slope of grass between the house and the driveway, then overbalanced and fell on his back. For a moment he lay there with his legs drawn up, looking as helpless as a turtle in its shell. Then he slowly rolled over on his side, and began the terrible job of getting to his knees again. His uniform, shirt, and pants were darkening with blood. Small patches were slowly spreading, meeting other patches, growing bigger still. The smoky reached the driveway. Suddenly the noise of the riding lawnmower was louder.
"Look out!"
Paul screamed.
"Look out! She's coming!"
The cop turned his head. Groggy alarm surfaced on his face, and he grappled for his gun once more. He got it out, something big and black with a long barrel and brown wood grips. And then Annie reappeared, sitting tall in the saddle and driving the lawn boy as fast as it would go.
"Shoot her!"
Paul screamed. And instead of shooting Annie Wilkes with his big old dirty birdie, Harry gun, he first fumbled, then dropped it. He stretched out his hand for it. Annie swerved and ran over both his reaching hand and his forearm. Blood squirted from the lawn boy's grass exhaust in an amazing jet. The kid in the trooper uniform screamed. There was a sharp clang as the mower's whirling blade struck the pistol. Then Annie was swerving up the side lawn, using it to turn, and her gaze fell on Paul for 1 second, and Paul felt sure he knew what that momentary gaze meant. First the smoky, then him. The kid was lying on his side again. When he saw the mower bearing down on him, he rolled over on his back and dug frantically at the driveway dirt with his heels, trying to push himself under the cruiser where she couldn't get him. He didn't even come close. Annie throttled the riding lawnmower up to a scream and drove it over his head. Paul caught a last glimpse of horrified brown eyes, saw tatters of brown khaki uniform shirt hanging from an arm raised in a feeble effort at protection, and when the eyes were gone, Paul turned away. The lawn boy's engine suddenly lugged down, and there was a series of fast, strangely liquid thudding sounds. Paul vomited beside the chair with his eyes closed. He only opened them when he heard the rattle of her key in the kitchen door. His own door was open. He watched her approach down the hall in her old brown cowboy boots and her blue jeans, with a key ring dangling from one of the belt loops and her man's T-shirt now spotted with blood. He cringed away from her. He wanted to say, "If you cut anything else off me, Annie, I'm going to die. It won't take the shock of another amputation, either. I'll die on purpose." But no words came out, only terrified chuffing noises that disgusted him. She gave him no time to speak anyway.
"I'll deal with you later," she said,
and pulled his door closed. One of her keys rattled in the lock, a new Krieg that would have defeated even Tom Twyford himself, Paul thought. And then she was striding down the hall again, the thud of her boot heels mercifully diminishing. He turned his head and looked dully out the window. He could see only part of the trooper's body. His head was still under the mower, which was in turn canted at a drunken angle against the cruiser. The riding mower was a small tractor-like vehicle, meant for keeping larger-than-average lawns neat and clipped. It had not been designed to keep its balance as it passed over jutting rocks, fallen logs, or the heads of state troopers. If the cruiser hadn't been parked exactly where it was, and if the trooper hadn't gotten exactly as close to it as he had before Annie struck him, the mower would almost surely have tipped over, spilling her off. This might have caused her no harm at all, but it might have hurt her quite badly. "She has the luck of the devil himself," Paul thought drearily, and watched as she put the mower in neutral, and then pushed it off the trooper with one hard shove. The side of the mower squalled along the side of the cruiser and took off some paint. Now that he was dead, Paul could look at him. The cop looked like a big doll that has been badly treated by a gang of nasty children. Paul felt a terrible aching sympathy for this unnamed young man, but there was another emotion mixed with that. He examined it and was not much surprised to find it was envy. The trooper would never go home to his wife and kids, if he had them. But on the other hand, he had escaped Annie Wilkes. She grabbed a bloody hand and dragged him up the driveway and through the barn doors, which stood ajar on their tracks. When she came out, she pushed them along their tracks as far as they would go. Then she walked back down to the cruiser. She was moving with a calm that was almost serenity. She started the cruiser and drove it into the barn. When she came out again, she closed the doors almost completely, leaving a gap just wide enough for her to slip in and out. She walked halfway down the driveway and looked around, hands on her hips. Again, Paul saw that remarkable expression of serenity. The bottom of the mower was smeared with blood, particularly around the grass exhaust, which was still dripping. Little scraps of khaki uniform lay in the driveway, or fluttered in the freshly cut grass of the side lawn. There were daubs and splashes of blood everywhere. The trooper's gun, with a long slash of bright metal now scarring its barrel, lay in the dust. A square of stiff white paper had caught on the spines of a small cactus Annie had set out in May. Bossy's splintered cross lay in the driveway, like a comment on the whole filthy mess. She moved out of his field of vision, heading toward the kitchen again. When she came in, he heard her singing. "She'll be driving 6 white horses when she comes. She'll be driving 6 white horses when she comes. She'll be driving 6 white horses, driving 6 white horses. She'll be driving 6 white horses when she comes." When he saw her again, she had a big green garbage bag in her hands, and 3 or 4 more sticking out of the back pockets of her jeans. Big sweat stains darkened her t-shirt around her armpits and neck. When she turned, he saw a sweat stain that looked vaguely tree-like rising up her back. "That's a lot of bags for a few scraps of cloth," Paul thought. But he knew that she would have plenty to put in them before she was done. She picked up the shreds of uniform and then the cross. She broke it into 2 pieces and dropped it into the plastic bag. Incredibly, she genuflected after doing this. She picked up the gun, rolled the cylinder, dumped the slugs, put them in 1 hip pocket, snapped the cylinder back in with a practiced flick of her wrist, and then stuck the gun in the waistband of her jeans. She plucked the piece of paper off the saguaro and looked at it thoughtfully. She stuck it into the other hip pocket. She went to the barn, tossed the garbage bags inside the doors, then came back to the house. She walked up the side lawn to the cellar bulkhead, which was almost directly below Paul's window. Something else caught her eye. It was his ashtray. She picked it up and handed it politely to him through the broken window. "Here, Paul." Numbly, he took it. "I'll get the paper clips later," she said, as if this were a question which must have already occurred to him. For 1 moment he thought of bringing the heavy ceramic ashtray down on her head as she bent over, cleaving her skull with it, letting out the disease that passed for her brains. Then he thought of what would happen to him, what could happen to him, if he only hurt her, and put the ashtray where it had been with his shaking, thumbless hand. She looked up at him.
"I didn't kill him, you know."
"Annie."
"You killed him. If you'd kept your mouth shut, I would have sent him on his way. He'd be alive now, and there would be none of this oogie mess to clean up."
"Yes," Paul said. "Down the road he would have gone. And what about me, Annie?" She was pulling her hose out of the bulkhead and looping it over her arm.
"I don't know what you mean."
"Yes, you do." In the depth of his shock, he had achieved his own serenity. "He had my picture. It's in your pocket right now, isn't it?"
"Ask me no questions, and I will tell you no lies."
There was a faucet bib on the other side of the house to the left of his window. She began to screw the end of the hose into it. "A state cop with my picture means someone found my car. We both knew someone would. I'm only surprised it took so long. In a novel, the car might be able to float right out of the story. I guess I could make people believe it if I had to. But in real life, no way. But we went on fooling ourselves just the same, didn't we, Annie? You because of the book. Me because of my life. Miserable as it has become to me.
I don't know what you're talking about.
She turned on the faucet.
All I know is you killed that poor kid when you threw the ashtray through the window. You're getting what might happen to you mixed up with what already happened to him.
She grinned at him. There was craziness in that grin, but he saw something else in it as well, something that really frightened him. He saw conscious evil in it, a demon capering behind her eyes. You bitch, he said.
Crazy bitch, isn't that right?
She asked, still smiling. Oh, yeah, you're crazy, he said.
Well, we'll have to talk about that, won't we? When I have more time. We'll have to talk about that a lot. But right now I'm very busy, as I think you can see.
She unreeled the hose and turned it on. She spent nearly half an hour hosing blood off the mower and driveway and the side lawn, while interlinked rainbows glimmered in the spray. Then she twisted the nozzle off and walked back along the hose's length, looping it over her arm. There was still plenty of light, but her shadow trailed long behind her. It was now 6 o'clock. She unscrewed the hose, opened the bulkhead, and dropped the green plastic snake inside. She closed the bulkhead, shot the bolt, and stood back, surveying the puddly driveway and the grass, which looked as though a heavy dew had fallen upon it. Annie walked back to the mower, got on, started it up, and drove it around back. Paul smiled a little. She had the luck of the devil, and when she was pressed, she had almost the cleverness of the devil. But almost was the key word. She had slipped in Boulder, and wriggled away mostly due to luck. Now she had slipped again. He had seen it. She had washed the blood off the mower but forgotten the blade underneath, the whole blade housing for that matter. She might remember later, but Paul didn't think so. Things had a way of dropping out of Annie's mind once the immediate moment was past. It occurred to him that the mind and the mower had a lot in common. What you could see looked all right. But if you turned the thing over to take a look at the works, you saw a blood-slimed killing machine with a very sharp blade. She returned to the kitchen door and let herself into the house again. She went upstairs, and he heard her rummaging there for a while. Then she came down again, more slowly, dragging something that sounded soft and heavy. After a moment's consideration, Paul rolled the wheelchair across to his door and leaned his ear against the wood. Dim, diminishing footfalls, slightly hollow, and still that soft flumping sound of something being dragged. Immediately his mind lit up with panicky floodlights, and his skin flushed with his terror. Shed. She's gone to the shed to get the axe. It's the axe again. But this was only a momentary atavism, and he pushed it roughly away. She hadn't gone into the shed. She was going down cellar, dragging something down cellar. He heard her come up again, and he rolled back to the window. As her boot heels approached the door, as the key slid into the lock again, he thought, "She's come to kill me." And the only emotion this thought engendered was tired relief. The door opened and Annie stood there, looking at him contemplatively. She had changed into a fresh white T-shirt and a pair of chinos. A small khaki bag, too big to be a purse and not quite big enough to be a knapsack, was slung over one shoulder. As she came in, he was surprised to find himself able to say it, and say it with a certain amount of dignity. "Go ahead and kill me, Annie, if that's what you mean to do. But at least have the decency to make it quick." Don't cut anything more off me. I'm not going to kill you, Paul. She paused. At least not if I have just a little luck. I should kill you. I know that. But I'm crazy, right? Crazy people don't often look after their own best interests, do they? She went behind him and propelled him across the room, out the door, and down the hall. He could hear her bag slapping solidly against her side, and it occurred to him that he had never seen her carrying a bag like that before. If she went to town in a dress, she carried a big, clunky purse, the sort of purse maiden aunts tote to church jumble sales. If she went in pants, she went with a wallet stuck in her hip pocket like a man. The sunlight slanting into the kitchen was strong, bright gold. Shadows from the legs of the kitchen table lay across the linoleum in horizontal stripes like the shadows of prison bars. It was 6:15 according to the clock over the range, and while there was no reason to believe she was any less sloppy about her clocks than her calendars, the one out here had actually made it to May. That seemed about right. He could hear the first evening crickets tuning up in Annie's field. He thought, I heard that same sound as a small, unhurt boy. And for a moment he nearly wept. She pushed him into the pantry, where the door to the basement stood open. Yellow light staggered up the stairs and fell dead on the pantry floor. The smell of the late winter rainstorm which had flooded it still lingered. Spiders down there, he thought. Mice down there. Rats down there. Uh-uh, he told her. Count me out. She looked at him with a level sort of impatience, and he realized that since killing the cop she had seemed almost sane. Her face was the purposeful of slightly harried face of a woman making ready for a big dinner party. You're going down there, she said. The only question is whether you're going down piggyback or bum over tea kettle. I'll give you 5 seconds to decide. Piggyback, he said at once. Very wise. She turned around so he could put his arms around her neck. Don't do anything stupid like trying to choke me, Paul. I took karate class in Harrisburg. I was good at it. I'll flip you. The floor is dirt, but very hard. You'll break your back. She hoisted him easily. His legs, now unsplinted, but as crooked and ugly as something glimpsed through a rip in the canvas of a freak show tent, hung down. The left, with a salt dome where the knee had been, was fully 4 inches shorter than the right. He had tried standing on the right leg, and had found he could for short times, but doing so produced a low, primal agony that lasted for hours. The dope couldn't touch that pain, which was like a deep physical sobbing. She carried him down and into a thickening smell of old stone and wood and flood and rotting vegetables. There were 3 naked light bulbs. Old spider webs hung in rotting hammocks between bare beams. The walls were rock, carelessly chinked. They looked like a child's drawing of rock walls. It was cool, but not a pleasant cool. He had never been as close to her as he was then, as she carried him piggyback down the steep stairs. He would only be as close once again. It was not a pleasant experience. He could smell the sweat of her recent exertions, and while he actually liked the smell of fresh perspiration, he associated it with work, hard effort, things he respected. This smell was secretive and nasty, like old sheets thick with dried cum. And below the smell of sweat was a smell of very old dirt. Annie, he guessed, had gotten as casually catch-as-catch-can about showering as she had about changing her calendars. He could see dark brown wax plugging one ear, and wondered with faint disgust how the hell she could hear anything. Here, by one of the rock walls, was the source of that flumping, dragging sound. A mattress. Beside it, she had placed a collapsed TV tray. There were a few cans and bottles on it. She approached the mattress, turned around, and squatted.
Get off, Paul.
He released his hold cautiously and allowed himself to fall back on the mattress. He looked up at her warily as she stood and reached into the little khaki bag. No, he said immediately, when he saw the tired yellow cellar-like gleam on the hypodermic needle. No, no.
Oh, boy, she said. You must think Annie's in a real poopy-doopy mood today. I wish you'd relax, Paul.
She put the hypo on the TV tray.
That's scopolamine, which is a morphine-based drug. You're lucky I have any morphine at all. I told you how closely they watch it in the hospital pharmacies. I'm leaving it because it's damp down here and your legs may ache quite badly before I get back. Just a minute.
She gave him a wink which had strangely unsettling undertones. A wink one conspirator might give another.
You throw one cock-a-doodle ashtray, and I'm as busy as a one-armed paper hanger. I'll be right back.
She went upstairs and came back shortly with the cushions from the sofa in the parlor and the blankets from his bed. She arranged the cushions behind him so he could sit up without too much discomfort, but he could feel the sullen chill of the rocks even through the cushions, waiting to steal out and freeze him. There were three bottles of Pepsi on the collapsed TV tray. She opened two of them, using the opener on her keyring, and handed him one. She upended her own and drank half of it without stopping. Then she stifled a burp, ladylike, against her hand.
"We have to talk," she said. "Or rather, I have to talk, and you have to listen."
"Annie, when I said you were crazy..."
"Hush, not a word about that. Maybe we'll talk about that later. Not that I would ever try to change your mind about anything you chose to think. A Mr. Smart guy like you who thinks for a living. All I ever did was pull you out of your wrecked car before you could freeze to death, and splint your broken legs, give you medicine to ease your pain, take care of you, talk you out of a bad book you'd written and into the best one you ever wrote. And if that's crazy, take me to the loony bin."
Oh, Annie, if only someone would, he thought. And before he could stop himself, he had snapped.
"You also cut off my fucking foot."
Her hand flickered out whip-like and rocked his head over to one side with a thin, spatting sound.
"Don't you use that F-word around me,"
Annie said.
"I was raised better even if you weren't. You're lucky I didn't cut off your man gland. I thought of it, you know."
He looked at her. His stomach felt like the inside of an ice maker. "I know you did, Annie," he said softly. Her eyes widened, and for just a moment she looked both startled and guilty. Naughty Annie instead of nasty Annie.
"Listen to me. Listen closely, Paul. We're going to be all right if it gets dark before anyone comes back to check on that fella. It'll be full dark in an hour and a half. If someone comes sooner..."
She reached into the khaki bag again and brought out the Trooper's .44. The cellar lights shone on the zigzagging lightning bolt the lawn boy's blade had chopped into the gun's barrel.
"If someone comes sooner, there's this," she said. "For whoever comes, then you, then me."
Once it was dark, she said, she was going to drive the police cruiser up to her laughing place. There was a lean-to beside the cabin where she could park it safely out of sight. She thought the only danger of being noticed would come on Route 9, but even there the risk would be small. She only had to drive 4 miles of it. Once she was off 9, the way into the hills was by little-traveled meadow-line roads, many fallen into casual disuse as grazing cattle this high up became a rarity. A few of these roads, she said, were still gated off. She and Ralph had obtained keys to them when they bought the property. They didn't have to ask. The owners of the land between the road and the cabin gave them the keys. This was called neighboring, she told Paul, managing to invest a pleasant word with unsuspected depths of nuance, suspicion, contempt, bitter amusement.
"I'd take you with me just to keep an eye on you, now that you've shown how untrustworthy you can be, but it wouldn't work. I could take you up there in the back of the police car, but getting you back down would be impossible. I'm going to have to ride Ralph's trail bike. Probably fall off and break my cock-a-doodle neck."
She laughed merrily to show what a joke on her that would be, but Paul did not join her. If that did happen, Annie, what would happen to me?
You'll be fine, Paul, she said serenely. Gosh, you're such a worrywart.
She walked over to one of the cellar windows and stood there a moment, looking out, measuring the fall of the day. Paul watched her moodily. If she fell off her husband's bike or drove off one of those unpaved ridge roads, he did not actually believe he would be fine. What he actually believed was that he would die a dog's death down here, and when it was finally over, he would make a meal for the rats which were even now undoubtedly watching those two unwelcome bipeds who had intruded upon their domain. There was a Krieg lock on the pantry door now, and a bolt on the bulkhead almost as thick as his wrist. The cellar windows, as if reflecting Annie's paranoia, and there was nothing strange about that, he thought. Didn't all houses come after a while to reflect the personalities of their inhabitants? Were not much more than dirty gunslits, about 20 inches long by 14 wide. He didn't think he could have wriggled through one of those even on his fittest day, which this wasn't. He might be able to break one and yell for help if someone showed up here before he starved to death, but that wasn't much comfort. The first twinges of pain slipped down his legs like poisoned water, and the want. His body yelling for Novril. It was the Gata, wasn't it? Sure it was. Annie came back and took the third bottle of Pepsi.
I'll bring down another couple of these before I go, she said. Right now I need the sugar. You don't mind, do you?
Absolutely not. My Pepsi is your Pepsi. She twisted the cap off the bottle and drank deeply. Paul thought, chug-a-lug, chug-a-lug. Make you want to holler hidey-ho. Who was that? Roger Miller, right? Funny, the stuff your mind coughed up. Hilarious.
I'm going to put him in his car and drive it up to my laughing place. I'm going to take all his things. I'll put the car in the shed up there and bury him in his, you know, his scraps, in the woods up there.
He said nothing. He kept thinking about Bossy, bawling and bawling and bawling until she couldn't bawl anymore, because she was dead. And another of those great axioms of life on the western slope was just this. Dead cows don't bawl.
I have a driveway chain. I'm going to use it. If the police come, it may raise suspicion. But I'd rather have them suspicious than have them drive up to the house and hear you make a big cock-a-doodie fuss. I thought of gagging you, but gags are dangerous, especially if you're taking drugs that affect respiration. Or you might vomit. Or your sinuses might close up because it's so damp down here. If your sinuses closed up tight and you couldn't breathe through your mouth.
She looked away, unplugged, as silent as one of the stones in the cellar wall, as empty as the first bottle of Pepsi she had drunk. Make you want to holler hidey-ho. And had Annie hollered hidey-ho today? Bet your ass. Oh, brethren. Annie had yelled hidey-ho until the whole yard was oogie. He laughed. She made no sign she had heard him. Then slowly she began to come back. She looked around at him, blinking.
I'm going to stick a note through one of the links in the fence, she said slowly, regathering her thoughts. There's a town about 35 miles from here. It's called Steamboat Heaven. Isn't that a funny name for a town? They're having what they call the world's biggest flea market this week. They have it every summer. There's always lots of people there who sell ceramics. I'll write in my note that I'm there, in Steamboat Heaven, looking at ceramics. I'll say I'm staying overnight. And if anyone asks me later where I stayed, so they can check the register, I'll say there were no good ceramics, so I started back. Only I got tired. That's what I'll say. I'll say I pulled over to take a nap because I was afraid I might fall asleep behind the wheel. I'll say I only meant to take a short nap, but I was so tired from working around the place that I slept all night.
Paul was dismayed by the depth of this slyness. He suddenly realized that Annie was doing exactly what he could not. She was playing Can You in real life. Maybe, he thought, that's why she doesn't write books. She doesn't have to.
I'll get back just as soon as I can, because policemen will come here, she said.
The prospect did not seem to disturb Annie's weird serenity in the least, although Paul could not believe that in some part of her mind she did not realize how close to the end of the game they had now come.
I don't think they'll come tonight, except maybe to cruise by. But they will come. As soon as they know for sure he's really missing, they'll go all along his route, looking for him, trying to find out where he's stopped, you know, showing up. Don't you think so, Paul?
Yes.
I should be back before they come. If I start out on the bike at first light, I might even be able to make it back before noon. I should be able to beat him, because if he started from Sidewinder, he would have stopped at lots of places before he got here. By the time they come, you should be back in your own room, snug as a bug in a rug. I'm not going to tie you up or gag you, or anything like that, Paul. You can even peek when I go out to talk to them. Because it'll be two next time, I think. At least two, don't you think so?
Paul did. She nodded, satisfied.
But I can handle two if I have to.
She patted the khaki purse.
I want you to remember that kid's gun while you're peeking, Paul. I want you to remember that it's going to be in here all the time I'm talking to those police when they come tomorrow or the next day. The bag won't be zipped. It's all right for you to see them. But if they see you, Paul, either by accident or because you try something tomorrow like you did today, if that happens, I'm going to take the gun out of the bag and start shooting. You're already responsible for that kid's death.
Bullshit, Paul said, knowing she would hurt him for it but not caring. She didn't, though. She only smiled her serene maternal smile.
Oh, you know, she said. I don't kid myself that you care. I don't kid myself about that at all. But you know. I don't kid myself that you'd care about getting another two people killed if it'd help you. But it wouldn't, Paul. Because if I have to do two, I'll do four. Them and us. And do you know what? I think you still care about your own skin.
Not much, he said. I'll tell you the truth, Annie. Every day that passes, my skin feels more and more like something I want to get out of. She laughed.
Oh, I've heard that one before. But let them see you put one hand on their oogie old respirators. Then it's a different story, yes. When they see that, they yell and cry and turn into a bunch of real brats.
Not that you ever let that stop you, right, Annie?
Anyway, she said, I just wanted you to know how things are. If you really don't care, yell your head off when they come. It's entirely up to you.
Paul said nothing.
When they come, I'll stand right out there in the driveway. Say yes. There was a state trooper that came by here. I'll say he came just when I was getting ready to leave for Steamboat Heaven to look at the ceramics. I'll say he showed me your picture. I'll say I hadn't seen you. And one of them will ask me, this was last winter, Miss Wilkes, how could you be so positive? And I'll say, if Elvis Presley was still alive and you saw him last winter, would you remember seeing him? And he'll say, yeah, probably so, but what does that have to do with the price of coffee in Borneo? And I'll say, Paul Sheldon is my favorite writer, and I've seen his pictures lots of times. I have to say that, Paul. Do you know why?
He knew. Her slyness continued to astound him. He supposed it shouldn't, not anymore, but it did. He remembered the caption below the picture of Annie in her detainment cell, the picture taken in the caesura between the end of the trial and the return of the jury. He remembered it word for word. In misery? Not the dragon lady. Annie reads calmly as she waits for the verdict.